Don't get left in the dark. Let us shine a light on everything you need to know. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
.1204 Sportsnet Tonight, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, George Russick, Show Ali with you. The next 51 minutes of your listening pleasure. Dodgers win game one over the Rays 8-3. Clayton Kershaw dazzles for the Dodgers in game one, goes six innings, gives up just two hits, one run, a home run to Kevin Kiermaier with one walk and eight strikeouts. Clayton Kershaw was dealing, and for a guy that we had Scott Miller on from the Bleacher Report, Turner Sports, and Sirius XM MLB Radio, we asked him the question, is Clayton Kershaw really a huge playoff choke artist? And if you look at the numbers tonight, Joe, Kershaw 19 swings and misses in game one. His eight strikeouts now puts him second on the all-time list for playoff strikeouts. Justin Verlander leads. Kershaw's now alone in second, two ahead of John Smoltz. And more playoff goodness from Clayton Kershaw. Now he is 12th on the all-time Major League Baseball postseason win list. He's climbing the ladder. He is only two behind third place, which is held by Justin Verlander and Tom Glavine. He was fantastic tonight. Is this the performance show that the narrative is finally dead, or we might see it in game five?
I feel like for the people who are really hardcore Clayton Kershaw detractors, I feel like he's gonna have to do it one more time. For me, I don't think so. For me, I'm not sure it really changes his legacy all that much, mainly because I don't really think it was all that bad personally to begin with. But I do think that for those who really bag on him, he's gonna have to do it in a much more high leverage spot, like you said, probably in game five at this rate, if the Rays do come back and win one of these next couple games here for the rest of the week. But it's funny because you mentioned his eight strikeouts. I mean, I think seven of those strikeouts they showed on the broadcast. Seven of those strikeouts, George, were just really nasty sliders, and one was on a curveball. I mean, he was dealing tonight. I mean, I don't think there's anything really anybody, even the harshest of Kershaw criticisms, could really say about what he did on the mound tonight.
Yeah, he was fantastic for the Dodgers. On our show coming up, Michael Schwartz, associate football editor for USA Today, will join us in about 10 minutes. We'll look around the National Football League. Our pal Dan Riccio from Sportsnet 650 in Vancouver. Lots of Champions League action, and could the Champions League be coming to an end? And Dan had a tweet that went viral over the weekend. We'll ask him about that. But, show. The Tampa Bay Rays, and we talked with Scott Miller about this, and you and I talked about how, to me, the Tampa Bay Rays just suck the fun out of everything that is baseball. It's all a computer. It's all analytics. There's no feel. So can you please explain to me, while Kevin Cash leaves Tyler Glasnow in with 112 pitches, when he was clearly struggling there in that fifth inning, and then he pulls Charlie Morton after 66 pitches and was absolutely dealing on Saturday night?
Yeah, the only answer I really have for you, George, is that the computers were offline. The computers must have overheated at some point. They messed up. You know, there was a virus introduced. The Dodgers did something.
Because, Russian hackers.
Yeah, exactly. Like something went wrong with the computers because, yes, Kevin Cash otherwise.
The 2016 U.S. election. Yep, 2016 U.S. election, game one of the 2020 World Series. Let's blame Russian hackers for the Tampa Bay Rays.
I'm on board. Yeah, I mean, look, it was his play before that was really alarming, right? I mean, he had been struggling with command, or at the very least, he'd been struggling getting the Dodgers to bite on any of his pitches. The Dodgers, obviously, with that kind of hitting potential that they have at any given moment, you think that alone, with all the walks he had been issuing, would have been something to get Kevin Cash's eyebrows raised. But I mean, you would think also that give Glasnow's arm is going to be really important for his starts, you know, with the return to the normal format now that there are no more it's not going to be just a straight run, not a dead sprint. There are breaks in the World Series here, right? And it's just there was no reason at the very least for Cash not to have a guy warming up in the bullpen at the start of the inning, see how he does against the first batter and make a decision based on that. And then he walked the first batter. So, I mean, look, this is I personally put this completely on Kevin Cash, and it remains to be seen how they manage Blake Snell tomorrow, because Ryan Yarbrough is already used and Fleming was already used tonight. So yeah, we'll have to see how the rest of that bullpen does in game two tomorrow.
So maybe sometimes the way I feel things when I watch sports, maybe it makes me a bad person, or maybe it doesn't, because I like having joy in other fan bases' misery. And I'm sure Red Sox fans, who, by the way, enough with the you're not poor boo-hoo you Red Sox fans. You broke the curse. The curse of the Bambino died a long time ago in 2004. You stormed back down 03, you beat the Yankees, and then you won the World Series. You've won three World Championships, including that 2004 since. And they traded Mookie Betts away because of cost-cutting measures to have more payroll flexibility, which is a buzzword that gets that people in this city love to use when talking about the Toronto Blue Jays. But were you like me, what he did tonight? 2 for 4, had a home run, couple stolen bases as well, free tacos in the United States next week. Did you take some joy that you know that Red Sox fans were watching that game and being miserable with how good Mookie Betts looked tonight?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. Absolutely, George.
So you're a bad person like me.
I am. I am absolutely a bad person. That has been for sure okay. Well established. Yes, I have no sympathy for Red Sox fans. Maybe that's like a homer take because I grew up cheering for the Blue Jays, but I mean, I don't really care. I feel no sympathy for them.
Yeah, I found myself cheering for the Dodgers tonight, even though I lost a bet. I told you I bet on the Rays, and
right,
that went down the tubes. They had a chance there in that seventh inning where they made a bit of a rally. But what an incredible play on that double play. But I'm kind of rooting for the Dodgers in this series because I just can't stand what Tampa Bay like stands for. And it's hilarious to me that they did the promos throughout the broadcast that, oh, get your official Rays and Dodgers gear. Nobody cares about the Tampa Bay Rays. Nobody goes and watches that team. The team should move to Montreal. Nobody in South Florida gives a rat's ass about the Tampa Bay Rays. I would love to see what the discrepancy is in merchandise sales for this World Series. What is it? 97-3, maybe, is the discrepancy, Dodgers to Rays? Like, what a soulless team and fan base the Tampa Bay Rays are. And God bless them for putting together everything that they do on a shoestring budget and how intelligent they are. And they've changed the game of baseball. I get it. They doubled down on what the Oakland A's did in Billy Bean with Moneyball. They've even took it to another level, and it's successful for them. But I dislike the Tampa Bay Rays. I hate their damn stadium, that awful, awful ballpark with the stupidest catwalk rules in all of baseball. I am rooting against the Tampa Bay Rays. I hate the fact that they smothered fun out of baseball and just continue to smother it till it stopped moving. I'm done with my rant. I'm cheering for the Dodgers.
If you say, I think you're probably right, George, in the sense that if the discrepancy in merch smothering is 97%, that also as well.
Okay,
but, all right. 97% to 3%. I bet the only 3% are Randy Arozarena jerseys. No one else from that team is selling jerseys.
Right. Yeah. Like again, Kevin Kiermaier. You know, he only seems to hit against the Blue Jays. Yeah, he had a home run tonight. Can't hit against anybody else. Carves up the Blue Jays like nobody's business. And yeah, it's just, I'm rooting for the Dodgers to get this done. I think it would be a nice story. A double championship in the city of Los Angeles would be insane, coupled with the Lakers NBA title. But I don't know, Sho, the way this is looking and how on fire that Dodgers lineup is right now, I got a sense that this is going to be a short series. Do you?
Yeah, you know what? I still want to say, based on what we've seen from the Dodgers, and I mean, if you think back to previous times during the World Series, they won game one, and in other series, even just this past postseason, they were blowing out teams and then just getting dusted in the very next game. So I don't necessarily think that I don't think that's necessarily going to happen here. But I want to say that my prediction is going to be Dodgers in six. And this does bleed into next week with the days off, but I really do think that the losses, if any, come for the Dodgers, will be close ones.
Game two goes tomorrow night. We'll have all the coverage here. It gets going at 7:30. Game two, Rays and Dodgers. Blake Snell on the mound for Tampa. It's a bullpen day for the Dodgers. We don't know who starts the game yet for Los Angeles, but we'll have all the coverage live right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. You can also watch it on Sportsnet. All right, it's 12:14 Sportsnet tonight. Georgian Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Week six is in the books. Week seven starts up now, tomorrow, because it's Wednesday. Michael Schwartz is an associate football editor for USA Today, and he joins us here on Sportsnet tonight. Michael, how are you? Thanks for this.
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. The big news from the NFL today is the Miami Dolphins have decided that it's Tua time, and they're benching Ryan Fitzpatrick after a 3-3 record, and they're right in the thick of a playoff race, especially with the expanded wild card in both conferences. Were you surprised, like I think many of us were, when Tua was announced the starter in 2 weeks against the Rams?
Yeah, I think you have to be. I mean, partially just because of where Miami stands, like you said, 3-3, right in the thick of things in the AFC East. But just, you know, it's obviously the bye is coming up, but you have a pretty formidable opponent in the Rams, and you know, throwing a rookie, you know, with Tua's injury history against Aaron Donald is a distinct gamble, especially with that offensive line. So this was obviously made with a long-term view of the franchise. I think that they still believe they can win with Tua this year, but this is clearly something that they're looking to, you know, turn the page and really find that quarterback that, you know, they've lacked pretty much since Dan Marino.
So Michael, what do the Dolphins do with Ryan Fitzpatrick now? Do you think it's more valuable for the Dolphins to keep him as a mentor in that mentorship role for Tua, or do you think it's perhaps worth shopping him around to another QB needy team, perhaps even the Cowboys?
I think that you have to keep him as a mentor. I think that he's provided great support for Tua so far this year, and I mean, right now the biggest thing for them is just maximizing Tua's play this year and beyond. And what you're able to get for Fitzpatrick is not going to be very great on the trade market with the trade deadline 2 weeks away. And I mean, Miami will be fine in terms of their draft haul, just with what they've built over the years. So at this point, you need to just keep Fitzpatrick and, you know, have him mentor Tua.
Michael, we know that a lot of teams, a lot of people, fans and media kind of forget that, yeah, you had Ryan Fitzpatrick as your starting quarterback in Miami, and dude's been around the block and he's an older guy, but the Dolphins are the youngest team in the NFL, and I know that the way to hire head coaches now should be offensive minds, but the job Brian Flores has done, a guy who's a special teams and defensive guy coming over from New England, I think he has to be right there in the coach of the year conversation, and just talk about what an incredible job that guy has done just changing the culture around in South Florida.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people talk this year about how bad the Jets are at 0-6, but I mean, just look back to where the Dolphins were when, I mean, just at the start of last year when they were just getting absolutely blown out and it didn't really seem like there was any hope for this franchise. And I think it's a testament to both Flores and the job they've done building this roster. Obviously, you still have to see how rookies and this draft haul pan out in the long term, but it's very impressive that you know, they're even at 3-3 at this point in the season. But I think the bigger thing, it's nice to see them be competitive, but you really want to see that long term improvement. So how two affairs in this, the final 10 weeks or so of the season is going to be very telling for this franchise's future.
So, Michael, one team we hear in Toronto love to talk about, the quasi-local team, the Buffalo Bills. They've now lost two in a row, sticking with the AFC East here. And, of course, they lost to the Titans and the Chiefs. Now, those are the two teams that made it to the AFC Championship game last year, so perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. Can we just chalk this recent losing streak up to they've just played two absolute buzzsaws of teams, two teams that are probably more two of the more complete ones in the AFC, or should we be perhaps a little more worried about the Bills?
I think that's certainly part of it, but that's kind of the crux of the issue with the Bills is they're certainly a playoff caliber team. And look, if this is the team that ends the Patriots' reign atop the AFC East, that's a historic achievement. But the question is, can they compete with the best of the best? Can they compete with the Chiefs and Titans? And, you know, after those performances, the answer certainly seems like no. And so, you know, you clearly have a well-coached team here. Sean McDermott has done a great job. Josh Allen made some impressive strides in the first 4 weeks, some troubling signs in the last couple. But the question now is, you know, can they, once they get to the playoffs, can they go on the road against the Chiefs or Titans and win that kind of game? I think that, you saw in the last couple games that it's just going to be such an uphill battle. And as the roster is constructed, you heard Josh Allen say after Monday night's loss that he can't afford to play like that. And this is, you know, indicative of where the Bills are. This is not the amazing defense that they've had from Sean McDermott in past years, and the running game isn't there. So they really do need him to be lights out, and when he's playing against top competition so far for the last couple of weeks, he just hasn't been there.
Michael Schwartz, associate football editor for USA Today, joining us here on Sportsnet Tonight, George and Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. One of those teams the Bills fell to was that Tuesday night game to the Tennessee Titans, and they survived in that overtime win against the Houston Texans. Michael, I know they're perfect on the season. They're 5-0. They have a showdown with the Steelers this weekend, but what are your thoughts on them being an upper echelon team in the AFC? I know Mike Vrabel has their defense playing much like a Bill Belichick type defense, bend the but don't break. But they've coughed up a ton of points. The Bills had struggles, but Deshaun Watson, they carved him up. Even the Vikings had a ton of success against the Titans. Is the Titans defense good enough to challenge teams like the Steelers, like the Chiefs, like the Ravens in the postseason?
Yeah, I think it's hard to tell at this point. It's certainly been more promising overall than I would have thought. The Texans game obviously being a hiccup, but you know, there's still sort of a question of going into the year. They obviously added Clowney, but there was still kind of a question of, is the pass rush really there, and you know, is the unit as a whole, you know, going to be up to par with the rest of the AFC? They've done some impressive things, but it's still kind of a question of are they going to be able to face the Steelers this week and slow them down. So, the Titans are an interesting team just because they don't do a lot of things conventionally. They're not, look at their offense and the fact that they have this complete anomaly in Derrick Henry, and that they've managed to revive Ryan Tannehill's career, not being a classic drop back offense, drop back passing game. I mean, they are not going to win the way the rest of the NFL does. But at this point, you know, it's more than a one season thing at this point. They've proven that it's not just luck. They're not just a one season outlier. So I think you have to give them some credit, but I think the Steelers game is really going to be a good test of just how far this team has come.
And on those Steelers, Mike, I mean, I'm just thinking about the teams we've talked about, right? Like, we've talked about the Bills, the Dolphins, and the Titans. And the Steelers, I guess, are kind of in the upper echelon of the AFC as well, right? I feel like it wouldn't be a stretch, and you can tell me if I'm wrong on this, but I feel like it wouldn't be a stretch to say that the Steelers perhaps are one of the three most complete teams, including the offense, defense, and special teams, coaching, everything, perhaps even in the entire NFL.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think you saw the big tests last week against the Browns, and they just really obliterated a team that was riding high coming into that game. But this defense just gives them the ability to compete with almost anyone. The pass rush is just outstanding, and they're just so aggressive. And I think that they are going to be able to stand up with the best of the best. And Ben Roethlisberger is still kind of finding his way back. There's opportunity to take some more deep shots, but I think that there's still room to grow on offense, and that defense is going to keep them competitive throughout the season.
Michael, you mentioned the Browns there real quick. I was just thinking, because you were saying they were riding high, and I wanted to say they were 4-1 going into last week's game against this past Sunday's game against the Steelers. How good are the Browns really? Like, because I go back and forth sometimes based on what we've seen. Like, it seems like they beat up on the bad teams, but they also, because I think their two losses on the year have been to the Steelers and the Ravens. So, I mean, it seems that they're kind of right in the middle of the pack, it seems.
Yeah, I think that you look at them, and again, relative to the rest of the AFC, they might have enough to make it into the playoffs, which, given where this Browns team has been in recent years, would be a phenomenal accomplishment. But then you look at those performances against the Ravens and the Steelers, and it's just hard to say that they're anywhere near competing with able to compete with the best of the best. That largely comes down to Baker Mayfield just not really being able to execute unless things go absolutely right, and that he is able to operate outside of the pocket and just have sort of everything clicking for him. I think they're at this point headed toward a really difficult decision on him, especially if, they end up with 9-10 wins and make the playoff field, but he's just holding them back. So I think that this is a team that they're well coached under Kevin Stefanski, and Myles Garrett is having a phenomenal defensive player of the year caliber season, and they have plenty going for them, but they just clearly are a step back from that top tier.
Michael, sticking to the theme of quarterbacks that need to elevate their play, Jimmy Garoppolo was good Sunday night in that kind of must win against the Rams. If you look at San Francisco's schedule, it is absolutely murderous the rest of the season. And he's a guy signed that huge, huge contract. I want to throw something your way that I've been thinking about. Are you ready for this crazy hot take?
Yeah, hit me.
Okay, so after this year, Jimmy G's dead cap money's $2.8 million in 2021. 2022 is just $1.4 million. Maybe they find a suitor. They trade away Jimmy G because the Falcons apparently, reportedly, are actively shopping Matt Ryan. Would Matt Ryan be a better fit, reunited with Kyle Shanahan in San Francisco, for them to potentially win that Super Bowl, that elusive Super Bowl finally? Would Matt Ryan give the Niners a better chance at a Super Bowl than Jimmy G at this point?
I think this 49ers team is just so difficult to figure out. In some ways, Garoppolo's play does limit them significantly, but they also just, what they are asking from their quarterback right now is so different from the rest of NFL teams, aside from, the Rams. It's kind of a, comparable situation of just asking him to execute very specific plays, serve a very specific role. I think it's hard to say with Matt Ryan, just because, it's hard to tell with Atlanta right now, just because of where that franchise is. I think that it would be a pretty hard sell, and just that Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch are just seem to have really, you know, decided to stand by Garoppolo through the various limitations and struggles. So, it'll be interesting if this season really goes south, if, you know, if they have to face those issues. And in the NFC West, you know, there's not a lot of room for error, just because all of those teams, you know, they're looking up at everyone else in the division right now. So they're going to have to answer for it. But I think that it's clear that in some ways Garoppolo's play is holding them back. But I don't know if they are going to be in a situation where they're going to look to ask for so much more.
Michael Schwartz, Associate Football Editor for USA Today. Michael, thanks for staying up with us tonight. This was great.
Appreciate you having me on.
There he goes, Michael Schwartz from USA Today. Yeah, it feels like I just don't get the excuses Jimmy G gets all the time. Oh, he had a high ankle sprain. He had this. He had that. I get it, all of it, but show they paid the guy $100 million to be that guy, right? He was supposed to be the heir apparent in New England. Bill Belichick and Tom Brady and Robert Kraft didn't want that to happen. They go and win a couple more Super Bowls. I understand all of that, but it's time for him to elevate his game and live up to those expectations that I think a lot of us still have. But where does it get to a point where we say that he's just an average quarterback?
I think he is. I gotta say, I think he is. I definitely thought he was going to be, like you said, they used the term heir apparent for the Patriots for a while. But, like, can you imagine, George, an alternate reality here where Jimmy G is the quarterback of the Patriots right now with the receivers, the makeshift offensive line that he has? It would be, I mean, they're struggling now even with a dynamic Cam Newton. And I feel like it would be so much worse, basically, if he had stayed in New England.
Yeah. And could you imagine if Tom Brady was the quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers,
sure,
with Kyle Shanahan, gosh, as his OC. That would be fascinating as well. Real quick, too, you talked about the Buffalo Bills, and, man, it is panic city right now in Buffalo. Listening to some Buffalo radio driving around today, man, they are in full panic mode with the Buffalo Bills, and I think they should be. That defense just looked lifeless last night in that game against the Kansas City Chiefs, and I think the score was kind to the Buffalo Bills, because the Chiefs just dominated that game and ran it down their throats with Clyde Edwards-Helaire. It's a bye week, essentially, for the Bills, because they get the Jets this week. Big fantasy sleeper defense this week. Take the Bills. I know they've been brutal, but Joe Flacco and the Jets have been worse than brutal. They have been an abomination.
Yeah.
But do you think the Bills can snap back with that defense? Because that's the hallmark of Sean McDermott's team. It was their defense, and they have just been flat out bad this season, show.
Yeah, they've been really bad. And I don't think any one guy being out, I don't think really excuses that either. Like, Matt Milano did not play, I guess, their best coverage linebacker, but that doesn't really excuse all of the other guys. I mean, I think one of the most concerning things were their leaders, their quote-unquote leaders on defense, who are supposed to be, you know, shining examples for the rest of the team, not only were doing dumb things in coverage, and they were just all playing on discipline. Like, they were committing penalties,
yeah,
lots of roughing the passer type stuff, or holdings, or pass interferences, or what have you, just all up and down the roster. That's the kind of thing that almost alarms me more than the poor play, because if a game against the Super Bowl champions can get them so out of sorts, then what happens when they go play the Patriots? Are they going to do the same that same thing? Like, what happens if the Dolphins are somehow in contention and they lose their composure down the stretch? Like, those are things that are probably less likely, I admit, because the Bills are still probably, I think, the best team in the AFC East right now. But, I mean, those kinds of things cannot happen full stop if they want to actually win the division this year.
Well, I was going to ask you, who do you think does win that division?
I do think the Bills still do win. I got to say, I do think they win. It'll be close. It won't be some kind of huge blowout runaway win like the Patriots have been used to over the past decade. But I do think the Bills will pull it together. Do you put any stock? I've been saying this a lot on social media lately. Do you put any stock into the Dolphins being a contender for the AFC East?
I think you have to, right? You have to look at some of their wins, and they've been impressive to do what they did. And obviously last week shutting out the Jets, that's okay, that's great. Nice hat tip for them. But what they did to the Niners, they went into San Francisco and kicked a hole in the 49ers show.
Yeah,
that's a wild, damn impressive victory for the Miami Dolphins. And they played tight with the Patriots. And if they don't get that PI call, which was a PI call late in that fourth quarter, who knows where that Patriots and Dolphins game went early on in the season. Yeah, I think they are a team that can potentially challenge the Bills and the Patriots for that division, because they're a super young team. There's a lot of talent on that team based on their draft. And the Patriots, to me, look like they're just discombobulated and don't look as daunting as they once did. They don't look as formidable as they did. It's just all those players that opted out, you just can't make up for guys like Chung and Hightower not being there on defense. And the offense, the lack of playmakers, yeah, they, outside of Julian Edelman, who at this point of his career he's super old and he's banged up. N'Keal Harry's been a bust. The draft pick they took, he has no weapons to throw to Cam Newton, and it feels like if they get down in football games like they did to the Broncos on Sunday, they're in a world of trouble because they can't score quick.
So you're telling me you don't believe in Damier Bird and Jacoby Myers?
No, I don't. I don't. And I think we saw that on Sunday's show when they went down, and the Broncos should have stomped the Patriots in that game. Six field goals? Are you kidding me right now? Just a couple of those touchdowns. That score, speaking of scores that were kind to teams, that score was kind to the Patriots because they should have got smoked in that game. And I think you're going to see that as the season progresses. If the Patriots are down, it's tough for them to come back. Great team that when they lead, they can pound the football and control the clock. But when they got to throw down the, when they got to throw the ball down the field, I think they're in trouble. All right.
Real quick, George. I had seen that a stat online saying that in the Bill Belichick era, when the opposing team does not score a touchdown, going into this game, he was 39-0, and now it's 39-1. So that's pretty telling, I think.
All these crazy stats. Week 7 kicks off tomorrow night. Giants and Eagles. Let's go. I'll be watching it, though. I'll be watching that entire freaking game. Actually, I have a show with Matt Marchese that night. I'll pay attention to both. All right, 12:36 straight ahead. We go from American football to the other type of football. Dan Riccio, co-host of Reach Deep 1-4 on our friend Sportsnet 960 in Vancouver, co-host of Kick in the Grass with Jeff Blair. We'll talk about what transpired today in the Champions League, look ahead to match day, the matches that'll be on later today. And is the Champions League time as a league? Is it on borrow time? We'll do that straight ahead. Dan Riccio, it's show, it's George, it's Sportsnet tonight, it's Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Well, 40. Sportsnet tonight. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. George Russick, show LA here for another 15 minutes or so. Later on in this program, we'll talk about a giant wiener. But right now, he is the co-host of Reach Deep. Afternoons from 1 to 4 on our friends at Sportsnet 650 in Vancouver. He's also the co-host of Kick in the Grass with Jeff Blair. We say good evening to Dan Riccio. Hey, pal, how are you?
Good. How you guys doing?
Well, we're terrific. Can we just address the giant elephant in the room before we talk soccer?
What's that?
You had a tweet that kind of went viral after the signing of Joe Thornton. Do you want to explain yourself?
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't think Leafs Nation was putting me on a pitchfork or anything last weekend. I didn't notice it at all.
Okay, so just what was it, like over 1,000 likes and what was it, retweets and stuff like that?
Yeah, I thought the ratio was going to end up being worse, but I guess there's a few people that are questioning John Tavares just like I am. Look, I don't mind the Joe Thornton signing for the Leafs. It's just weird all in conjunction with everything else that's going on there. They signed Wayne Simmonds and also Zach Bogosian. They already have Jason Spezza. Like, how many guys do you need that are about to head into the retirement home to add extra leadership at the bottom of the roster? It's just, I think there's a little bit too much of it going on, and it raises questions about the core that they have and the young core that's going on there too.
It feels like much of the same player, but to me, and I've said this many times, Dan, there's no such thing as a bad one-year deal in the NHL. The only thing I would be concerned about, and the only negative to me in all of this, is what if Joe Thornton's playing bad and they have to scratch him? How is that going to look on the organization?
Exactly. Hall of Famer, you're scratching him. We know the big story kind of, you know, was the prelude to Mike Babcock getting fired last year when he benched Jason Spezza on night one. So, I mean, these are questions that are going to come down the road for the Leafs, I'm sure. But, you know, I still think there's a big question mark on whether the John Tavares signing was really needed at the time. Of course, he's a great player, but they already had a lot of great forwards, and he hasn't really taken this team to a next level since he signed that big contract.
All right, so Reach, we got you on here. Also, of course, not just to rip you for your Leafs tweets, but also to chat about soccer. And George brought this up earlier, and we were chatting about it a little bit. The idea of this European Premier League, and of course, that the headline on Sky Sports was Liverpool and Man U in talks for a FIFA-backed tournament. Other clubs like Arsenal, Chelsea, Man City, Tottenham, also candidates to join this new European Premier League, backed by a total of £4.6 billion, which is pretty astronomical. Do you think then, should this go through, should this happen, would this be the end of the Champions League then?
I mean, this is so much speculation, and I think as the proposal or the story kind of reads to me is that this would be a spin-off of the Champions League. These would not see these clubs leave their current domestic leagues. Like, you're not going to see Liverpool or Manchester United leave the Premier League in order to join this European Premier League. It would be an addition to their schedules, which, look, it essentially would kind of make the Champions League moot. It would also really diminish the value of the domestic leagues, because teams, if they were in this European Super League, would focus their efforts towards winning that more so than their domestic championships. And it becomes a really convoluted issue. But what I think is going on here is really, this is like NFL owner wants a new stadium. So what's the thing that he does to try and leverage against the government to get himself a new stadium? He threatens relocation. Yeah, he threatens relocation. And that's kind of what's happening with Liverpool and Manchester United right now. They're not over the moon with the things going on in the Premier League. They want some reform, and they haven't been able to get it. So part of this, and part of the other big clubs around Europe doing this, is so that they can get more from their current domestic championships and get more leverage there and more, and even an even bigger piece of the pie, because they don't like sharing it so much with the little clubs.
Dan, you would obviously know more than I do, and if there's one competition I watch a ton of, it is the Champions League. To me, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Is there any flaws in that competition in your mind?
I don't think so. I think part of this, too, is to get some level of reform in the Champions League and maybe make it more focused on the biggest clubs in the world and not have to include some minnows from around Europe, so to speak, as we see in the early parts of the tournament usually. And that's part of where this conversation is, too, because those discussions are happening with UEFA right now about how they might change the Champions League a little bit, tweak it to make it more efficient, whatever that may be. I love the Champions League. I think it is the best tournament in the world. It is the most watched tournament in the world. When you get down to the final, it is the most watched sports match on an annual basis every single year, even more than the Super Bowl. It is the best teams, the best players every time they go out there. I think it's brilliant. And for me, there's no need to change that, because it's always the tournament that brings the most drama, especially when you get towards the end of the tournament and it's really all of just the biggest European giants and the best players in the world going against each other. It really does provide more drama even than the World Cup. It's just not as thought of that way because the World Cup is the tradition and it only happens every 4 years.
Right, yeah, I was going to ask you about the World Cup, but I guess that's the real sticking point, is that it's not an annual competition. I guess one thing about this, let's just say that they do get the changes they want, but I just wonder, I mean, you see the owners of Man U and the owners of Liverpool, and they're billionaires who are definitely familiar with the American side of things as well, and I've seen some people compare this potential change to a more American style of play, like a tournament in the NBA, for example. Do you think that, let's just say, they do change things about the ways the Premier League or the Champions League function, do you think that would ever trickle down at all to the grassroots level of soccer overseas?
I don't think so. And I think the governments, UEFA included, and the swift response that we saw from the story today from everyone around Europe, really showed how much they will guard against that and how big of a fight it would be to have that happen and to have kind of a closed league in the same way that MLS does, right? Or any of the North American sports leagues, really. Soccer and the European governments, the European associations really want to guard against that, and supporters really want to guard against that. They want the promotion and relegation system. And one of the things that is proposed in this European Premier League is that it would be closed. It would be the 18 biggest clubs in Europe, and at least for the first number of years, it would be exclusive to those clubs and not be changed. And they're going to get a ton of money out of that. That's not going to fly with a lot of people if they're to pull that off. And I think this is part of something that we're starting to notice as you're getting more and more American owners into the European leagues, like Liverpool and Manchester United, American owners. There's a ton of clubs in Italy that are starting to be owned by Americans as well. You're seeing it all around Europe. This is something that they're trying to bring in because they know what the cash cow is of the NFL, and they could see that European soccer would be even bigger than that in comparison to the moneymaker that it could be if they were to close the league that way.
Dan, before I let you go, unfortunately, we're short on some time. PSG lost today to Man United, and Man City in action later today against Porto. Out of Man City and PSG, which team needs to desperately win the Champions League more?
It's Manchester City. I mean, they spent over $500 million just on defenders in the Pep Guardiola era. So, I mean, if you're looking at a team that should have more Champions League success, it's the one that has the guy that was thought of to be the best coach on planet Earth, who's been given the most money and the most resources to build a super club and has watched Liverpool do it on a much smaller budget through the last couple of years. Manchester City definitely needs it more than PSG.
Dan Riccio is the co-host of Reach Deep, 1-4, Monday to Friday on Sportsnet 650. Also the co-host of Kicking the Grass with Jeff Blair. Reach, thanks for staying up for us tonight. Thanks for this, pal.
Yeah, cheers, boys. All the best.
There he goes. Straight ahead show, we'll talk about a giant wiener. We'll do that next. Sportsnet Tonight, Show and George, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
/12:53, Sportsnet Tonight, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. George Russick, Show Ali here for another couple minutes. We saw the Dodgers take Game 1 of the World Series, as you heard it live right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, 8-3. We'll have Game 2 for you later tonight. Pre-game gets going at 7:30, first pitch just after 8. But, Show, we talked about Globe Life Field in Arlington, Texas, with Scott Miller to kick off the show. Looks like a beautiful ballpark, but a Costco or flea market on the outside. And you were caught off guard by something they're serving at Globe Life Field. You want to tell us about it?
Sure, yeah. So I had seen this, of course, during the course of the game, and this was a video posted online. The boomstick, a 2-foot all beef hot dog, smothered in chili, nacho cheese, jalapeno peppers, and caramelized onion. It weighs 3 pounds and costs $27.50. 2-foot all beef hot dog. Oh man,
that
I would crush
massive...
like two of these. Oh man, give me two of these, George.
3 pounds of wiener. I don't think you can handle that. I wish they'd had. I wish once we're allowed to go watch baseball games at Rogers Center again, and who the hell knows when that'll happen. But honestly, how much of this do you think you could actually eat? Because it's probably like 8,000 calories for the whole thing. Of a 3-pound hot dog, you think you could eat a quarter of it?
I think, you know what? I think so. I truly, maybe if I didn't eat anything the whole day, then I went to the game and I ate this.
Like you amped your, you think you could eat half?
I'm not kidding. I think I could eat this whole thing. Maybe not in one, like not in,
get out of here.
Like, not in 5 minutes, but over the course of a baseball game, I could eat this thing.
Yeah. But wouldn't it get super gross and cold by the end?
Oh man, look, George, I'm the kind of person who like puts McDonald's sandwiches in the fridge and eats them like 3 days later. I don't care about that kind of thing.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, all the time.
Interesting.
I'll buy like a 2 double cheeseburgers and then save 1 double cheeseburger on a Monday and eat it on like a Thursday or something like that.
With the pandemic, we've all been watching weird stuff, and I've been watching The Weakest Link, the newest version. Have you seen any of this?
I've seen the promos with Jane Lynch, but I haven't actually watched.
Yeah, it's way easier than the original Weakest Link, but there was a question that you mentioned McDonald's, and I know you're a McDonald's connoisseur, and I'm going to ask you this question, which was on The Weakest Link last night before we go.
Okay.
What is the number one all-time selling item on the McDonald's menu in the United States?
Oh, man. I guess the fries?
Yes, Joe, yes! It is French fries.
Yeah, I guess the
Big Mac.
Right, yeah, yeah. That's the fries are the quintessential McDonald's thing.
Yeah, but now they say, nutritionists say, it's better for you to eat 2 burgers instead of the burger and the fries.
Really? Good God, it must be really salty. High sodium.
Yeah, because the fries are just horrendous for you. You're better off just eating 2 Big Macs instead of a Big Mac and the extra large fry. Show, we haven't done a show together in a long time. This was fun, although we were here for a good time. Not a long time. No clue when we'll be doing things together again, but I'm sure it'll be in the near future because November is around the corner when the only game in town is the NFL and Toronto FC. Buckle up for some more shows together coming up. Thanks for this, pal.
All right, I'll talk to you later, George.
Big thanks to producer Sam McKee and technical director Tom Young for their outstanding work as usual. I'm George. That was show CBS Sports Radio. We'll watch you while you sleep.